start my session or knowledge sharing actually by saying that it's a great pleasure and privilege to be part of a group that is aiming knowledge sharing. And I, to be honest, I have been in pains about, oh my God, and what am I going to talk, what kind of knowledge I would like to share with the group. But then when I first heard on the first day, I know some of you were here, some of you weren't here, when Ki-John said that he feels like a little bird trying to crack its egg after being exposed to feminist economics as a result of working with Rania, I said, perfect, I found what I'm going to do, because there is a song that I know, I think, well, and I can sing loud, and it's my own research, which is very dear to my heart. And so I decided to share the song that I sing best with all of you. So the outline of my presentation today is going to start with the motivation, and then I'm going to talk about why agriculture, very slightly, but you by now all know that what kind of, you know, how important it is. And then I'll try to situate myself in the overall framework and the literature and raise a central question. And hopefully, using Turkey as a case study, we'll be able to answer those this question, which is land ownership inequality bad for your mama, your papa, and your country, and in which ways? And hopefully I'll get to the gender land rights issue very briefly. I mean, my original research, as you all know, doesn't include gender, but I'm hoping to infer some insights on the topic. So starting with the motivation, a few of the statistics that hasn't been mentioned during the discussions is that there are 450 million people working in agriculture who have no land ownership, neither land access. And these people make 40% of the world's agricultural labor force. And what is more, 70% of child labor is also in agriculture. I mean, even in this country, 16% of all the migrant workers in the USA are female, and 66% of them bring their children with them. But my motivation about this research is actually, I mean, I have two. One is personal. And when I was conversing this with Rania, I told her a personal story, and she said, why don't you share it with the group? So this story goes like that. I am from a very, very large landed family. So one day, you know, my grandmother, who was the second wife of the landlord, who had seven wives, was working barefoot, her feet covered in sheep manure. And then an official, government official, comes to the village and enters the homestead and tells her, in an effort to tease her, lady, what kind of a landlord's wife are you? Your feet covered in sheep manure. And she says with great width and without hesitation, officer, those whose feet not covered in sheep dip can't find anything to eat. Which brings me to the second point, or second motivation. Well, those times were after the Second World War, with lots of government subsidies, when people working in agriculture, you know, were able to find something to eat, but this is not the case anymore, at least not for a lot of people, as a result of neoliberal policies. This is the case I'm going to make. Turkey got its fair share from neoliberal policies, and the most recent development of these policies is a program that's called Agricultural Reform Implementation Program, which started in 2001 and is just phased out in 2008, and it's substituting government substitutes with direct income cash transfers to the farmers. It's already phased out, and the subsidy is given on a per cultivation, you know, per acre. So long story short, which actually, you know, this is my research since 3 years, and I'm going to be jumping over many of the details and lots of really humongous literature around these issues. But in a nutshell, and I can always, you know, answer if you have any questions in the question answer section. The crux of the policy is putting the markets as the main decision makers in distributive and allocative, is the main player in the distributive and allocative roles in agricultural markets, basically. So I wanted to question if markets are really cut for that. And I wanted to question what could be some of the structures that may prevent markets to do a good job of being able to distribute or allocate the economic opportunities within the agricultural sector. Which brings me to the broader framework and a bit of the literature review, which I'm going to now locate myself in. You know, as we have all heard, pure neoclassical theories, their approach to markets are structures without power, without gender, they're power blind, gender blind. Especially in terms of looking at the inequality, you know, in the context of agriculture, if you have land endowments and labor endowments, as a result of the market exchange, each endowment should get their marginal returns to the factors. Therefore, the endowment inequality should map into income inequality perfectly. Of course, this is not the case in many of the developing countries because markets are not perfect. They don't necessarily translate the returns in the equal manner. So comes the transaction cost theories of development, which I again locate in the neoliberal school of thought. Transaction cost theories basically say that, well, endowments matter for sure. You know, it makes a difference in between a small farmer and a large farmer. A large farmer could access to credit easily, as opposed to a small one, and a small farmer therefore won't be able to engage in activities that's going to increase productivity. Therefore, results in a suboptimal outcome, which means that in imperfect markets, inequalities are enhanced. Well, that's pretty good, yes. However, one of the biggest flaws, I think, which I call, you know, their approach to the development economics don't go beyond transaction cost theories because they don't look at the structure, like what kind of structures affect the market functioning. In a way, they locate inequality as an outcome of the market functioning, but don't necessarily look at what makes that market function in specific ways, which brings me to the heterodox literature, particularly in terms of the studies of the agriculture, the structuralist. And they integrate power into their analysis and argue that power makes a difference. The power structure is actually the market maker. Sometimes agrarian organization is very much related to the inequalities in the market. So it's some sort of a dialectical relationship. Inequality is inequality generating, in a way. So this brings me to my main question, which is land ownership is a major structure that the rest of the rural economy rests on. And in an effort to, you know, kind of, not in an effort, when I'm starting my song about Turkey, I also would like to say that my method is going to be a method that is called analytical descriptive method by Agarwal. For all these descriptives that I'm going to show you, I actually have regressions as well for them, but I just wanted to choose the most common sense way. So let me start my song. First of all, locating the importance of agriculture for Turkey and then Turkey's importance for agriculture. Turkey's agriculture's contribution to Turkey's GDP is 11.5%. However, a good chunk of people are working still in agriculture, 30%. 40% of Turks live in rural areas, most of them earning their incomes from agriculture directly or agricultural sideline activities. And as a the result of a State Statistics Institute study on poverty, the sector is the home to the most crowded amount of poor people, and poverty has been rising fastest in the sector. Urban poverty rate in Turkey is around 17%. Rural poverty is around 32%, but the agrarian sector is 41% of all those who work in agriculture are under poverty, and since 2000 especially, since the implementation of these particular market-oriented programs, it has been growing extremely fast. So the importance of Turkey for agriculture, I don't know how many of you know about Turkey, but it's a geopolitically very strategically located region in between, in the Middle East, North Africa region, in between, you know, Christians and Muslims, East and West. We have 27% of all the arable land in Middle East, North Africa region and majority of the water resources. It is, by international standards, a major agricultural producer, ranks in the top one for apricots, hazelnuts, figs, and, you know, in the top five for 19 other products, which I'm not going to go into the detail. So the pictures I'm going to show you belongs to a World Bank survey that is conducted in 2002, which covers all seven regions of Turkey and 5,003 households, 363 towns and 500 villages, basically. So the argument I'm going to make by showing you some pictures, some tables from Turkey would be like through which mechanisms land ownership inequality. You know, this is kind of different from just land ownership, but I will also make references to land ownership as well. Affect different forms of tenure, innovate different forms of market structure within agriculture, its effect on credit, and also agricultural output outcomes in terms of farm size, which is, you know, the efficiency argument, and environment, and if we have time, empowerment, for particularly for women. So the first picture I'd like to show you, these are all based on my own calculations, is that, well, Turkey is a very unequal country in terms of land ownership distribution. The Gini coefficient is 0.65 nationally, and Aegean region is number one with 0.71, Mediterranean 0.68, and Southeast Anatolia 0.64. If you also pay attention to what these translate in terms of per capita land owned or per capita land hold, let me actually make a clarification for those who are not familiar with the agricultural literature. Land owned and land hold are different concepts. You can own land, or you can hold land without owning no land if you can access land through land tenancy, such as sharecropping and fixed rent tenancy, which I'll also elaborate later. So as you can see, these inequalities translate into smaller amounts of land. In these, you know, three top regions where the land inequality is higher, also land ownership and land holding per capita, which is per person, is the smallest. But what is more important and why I'm showing you this picture is to show the platform which markets are functioning. And if you look at the market participation, this is like agricultural markets, but these are factor markets, land and labor markets. They are most common in the regions where there is most land ownership inequality, which means that the markets are functioning on a platform which is extremely unequal. So now, we have been talking about how credit access is linked to, which is kind of a common sense now, that, you know, credit markets are imperfect because land is used as collateral, and therefore credit markets are very much linked to your ownership of land. And as you know, for out of seven regions, for five of them, you can see that when I divided my data set into those who have credit versus those who don't, you'll see that, of course, the causality is, you know, you have land and therefore you have credit, but you can see the clear link between if you have credit, you have more land ownership, or if you have, you know, higher amounts of land, then you can access to credit. Well, there is nothing really very novel about this, but maybe what is more interesting is that land tenancy is very much linked to that. And when I'm talking about land tenancy, I would like you really to keep in your mind that there is this close relationship between land ownership inequality, you know, and per capita small size land, and how it relates to credit. Because now I'm going to show you the patterns between credit access and the form of, you know, the choice of agricultural production, which is, you know, inequalities are market makers. They're basic structures that affect markets. And maybe before, you know, we start talking about markets, we should start talking about the major structures behind markets. Well, there are four forms of types of agrarian production. One is sharecropping, and I am jumping over humongous amount of literature about these. We'll just mention a few of the disincentives or the inefficiencies related to each. The second form, you know, sharecropping is a form of tenancy where the landlord provides land, the tenant provides labor, and there is no cash involved with this type of land tenure arrangement. At the end of the harvest, if the landlord is providing the input, you take the input out and share the output equally. Well, one of the most common points talked in the literature is the Marshallian disincentive hypothesis, which suggests that because the tenant can't get you know, can only get half of its marginal product of labor. There's a disincentive, therefore it is much less efficient. And I'm skipping over a lot of other critiques or pros and cons of this this form of tenancy. Fixed rent tenancy is when you have cash access, in advance you pay a certain amount of cash per acre for land, and then you are the full claimant of the residual, of the output. So you need to have some cash access, and one of the major critiques of this form of tenancy is in terms of environmental sustainability, which is when you don't own the land, you basically overkill it to get the maximum out of it. You put a lot of fertilizer in it. And the other form is wage labor, which brings the issue of supervision. Did I say so? Okay, supervision. You know, agricultural form of production is very different than a regular firm production. It's not as costly in industrial production because all the workers are in a confined space and they don't move. In agriculture, they are in an open space and they keep moving in an open field. And even if the worker doesn't shrink, you can never be sure that failed crop is as a result of their effort, because it could, you know, agricultural production is very risky, exposed to the vagaries of nature and weather. And the fourth one is owner cultivation, and the only critiques for the owner cultivation comes from the Marxist-Leninist side of the school of thought. You know, the theories of primitive accumulation suggest that small farmers are fetters to capitalist accumulation. Therefore, owner cultivation is not good for development. However, you know, as a structuralist, and I have to say that structuralists also specify country-specific rigidities and underlying structures, well, this may be valid, but I'm going to critique the Marxist approach in a sense that it is valid for countries who are really close to industrialization, where you can use that primitive accumulation if you have a very sustainable non-farm sector to absorb the employment. If you're like Turkey with 30% of unemployment for the population under 30 and almost 15% on unemployment, and this is not counting the discouraged workers, then for some countries like Turkey, this is really not a very valid critique. So now looking at the patterns for in between the choice of form of or type of agricultural organization and credit, there is a very clear pattern. Those who have access to credit, first of all, don't choose to participate to labor markets. Let me briefly mention the link between the credit and the labor market. You know, agriculture is a very risky production, and to diversify income is a way to diversify your agricultural output risk. So in the literature, it is discussed that if you have access to cash, you don't go and work in the agricultural labor markets, mostly because it's, you know, the lowest of the ladder, and it's basically back-breaking work. In sharecropping, of course, if you don't have cash, then your only form of being able to access the land markets is through sharecropping. And if you look at the data that Turkey is, I'm observing in Turkey, those who sharecrop do have much less credit access, and these are per capita numbers, than those who don't. And my data also confirms the literature on fixed rent tenancy. When you have cash, you go ahead and get engaged in fixed rent tenancy because it's a much more advantageous form of production from the tenant's perspective. I am actually basically building most of my arguments following an Indian agricultural economist, which Indra mentioned in the morning, Abhijit Sen, and trying to really give you the picture that how land ownership inequality or inequalities in the agricultural markets are really very crucial, because all other factor markets are supposed to be distributing economic alternatives to people, or economic opportunities are linked to each other. And you may say, oh, well, of course, you know, if you look at the picture between land ownership distribution and land holding distribution, there is almost a perfect one-to-one mapping. And you may say, of course, because, you know, land holding constitutes part of your ownership. However, in the neoclassical construction of markets, you know, markets are supposed to distribute land to those who make better use of it, and labor to those who make better use of it. So one should expect that, for example, I'm going to actually show you another picture how small farmers are much more productive than the large ones in Turkey. Markets should be distributing land more equally, even if the initial inequalities are high. But they're not doing it, and this is a regional aggregation. But if I also show you the picture of a provincial aggregation, the relationship is quite robust as well. So this term connectedness, for the first time in 1981 article by Abhijit Sen, was coined to show that how old rural markets are connected to the initial inequalities. And rural markets are much more isolated than urban markets because of their location, because the next market could be miles and miles away from your village. Moving on to the farm productivity per dekar. These are in Turkish liras, the monetary values, the small farmers versus larger ones, are producing in terms of agricultural output. Almost in every single region, there is a very clear pattern that as the farm size gets larger, the productivity per dekar, and dekar is almost one quarter of an acre, gets smaller. So on its own, it is almost an economic justification for land distribution. If you want to increase, and you know, again, keeping in mind that land and small holdings, you know, are much smaller in the areas with higher land inequality. This is basically an economic justification of land redistributive reforms, and in itself an evidence that markets really do not work. Because if I'm, you know, if I'm more productive in my land, markets should be able to allocate to me more land, but they don't do it. Or if, you know, on the opposite side, large farms have very high labor productivity, right? So markets should be allocating more labor towards large farms, which would create unemployment, but this is not the case. If you look at, you know, I question, like, why is this the case for small farms? And there are, you know, many discussions and a tremendous amount of literature on this subject, and I also do have a paper on the Livy website on this particular topic. But if you look at the labor input per dekar, you see that smaller farms, and these are really small farms, 20 dekar is like 5 acres basically, are using on the average 18 man days per dekar, as opposed to the very large ones, which are using 0.4. And now I'm going to come to, a little summary with much more striking numbers, that smallest farmer is 9 times more productive. And remember, the GDP contribution is 11.5% as opposed to 30% of employment, which is very unproductive. Now, even the left wing in Turkey, all academicians, World Bank, Food Agricultural Organization, OECD reports, without any evidence, say that if you want to increase productivity in Turkey, you should combine land because due to fragmentation problems, because you can't use machines on small lands, and they have no evidence, which I find it very ideological. But if you look at my numbers, smallest farmer is 9 times more productive, and they work 45 times more than a large farmer. So this, I just am going to make the point again. This brings me to the discussion of development, right? How we define development? Well, development is, you know, if you look at the developed countries versus developing countries, the purpose, like Bola mentioned, you know, agriculture is no fun sector to work. There is no need to romanticize agriculture. It's very hard work. So the purpose ultimately is definitely to increase the marginal productivity of labor. Yes, agreed. However, there is a way to increase marginal productivity of labor. If you just look at the numbers without putting the human in the center, you can hire only a few people for a large farm, calculate the marginal productivity of labor, and it's very high because he's using a major amount of land. But then the choice of technology really becomes a political question. You're using very few people and maybe machines, and there are 10,000 people out of the farm gate who are unemployed with zero marginal, you know, basically trying to survive. And then, the basically, the development discussion should be evaluated within the context, particularly given that in a country like Turkey, there is no non-farm unemployment capacity of the government or any other private sector to absorb that labor. However, the policies has been really tried to gear towards consolidating land, forming, you know, large farms. So now I'm going to show you a couple of my findings about the labor markets in the rural sector, in the agricultural sector in Turkey. And labor is the factor that poor people have most common. And I will start with, again, trying to poke into the neoclassical theory about this. First of all, it's important to mention the dual role of agricultural households. You know, some of you have heard me talking about, you know, agricultural households are both the producers and suppliers of both factors, like land, labor, capital, farm capital, and also the goods that they produce. So in perfect markets, you know, a utility maximizer farmer should be really, if markets are perfect, functioning, like suggested in the neoclassical sense, should be indifferent between selling his labor out or working on his own farm. So when he works on his own farm, he earns something what we call shadow wage. And there's then the market wage. So given, of course, all the imperfections in the market, determination of the shadow wage is more important in terms of the labor participation of the farmer in the labor markets, in the agrarian labor markets. I'm not going to go into the detail of how to calculate the shadow wage, but I've done it, and I can provide you the, you know, gory details about it. But the theory goes like that. The farmer basically operates within a band, which is, you know, the market or the wage. I call it sometimes the band, sometimes the market diversion. So upper limit of the band is basically the transaction cost, right? You have the effective wages paid inflated by supervision cost, because if it costs you to supervise, that's the upper band. And the lower limit is the effective wages earned by transportation or unemployment. You basically deflate, because it's not a guarantee that you're going to go out and find a job. You may rather choose to work on your farm. So you basically buy labor if wage paid is less than the shadow wage, or sell labor if it is more than what you can make on your own farm for yourself. So that has been offered around 1986 or 94 by, I forgot the name, by a really famous guy in the agricultural literature, as in the forms of agricultural household models. And I divided these models into two, microstructuralist and macrostructuralist. And as I mentioned earlier, microstructuralist are basically looking at the transaction cost. Like, what affects this band? And education is one part of it, because, you know, higher education increases the shadow wage. And their main message is, okay, well, we have a market. Some households can integrate it to the, you know, to market. Some households can participate to market. Some households can't. And I'm really, really jumping over major literature. But even though they recognize the importance of assets, they don't really look at the mechanism which perpetuates why markets function in such a way that creates inequalities. And the policy implication that comes with it is very scary, because it's, you know, you don't target markets. There's nothing wrong with markets, because some households can make it, some households can't. Therefore, the policies should be targeted toward rural households and not the market in general. Of course, this doesn't make sense, as the critique brought by the macrostructuralist, due to the limited capacity, you know, government capacities in most of the developing world. And their major focus is that land ownership inequality, you know, infrastructure or employment is a particular has a particular importance in the household's decision making. So what I did, in a way, is I calculated the shadow wages of the farms and wanted to see, do they, well, first of all, well, which we all know, in almost no country actually this is the case, to see do the markets really follow the neoclassical model? Like, are they equal? And I have, you know, run also regressions and statistically confirmed that that's not the case, but I'm just going to show you my picture. So my shadow wages and market wages never are the same in all the regions of Turkey, but what's more interesting maybe is the shadow wage is much higher than the market wage rate in the areas with higher land ownership inequality. And this is a case of labor monopsony, because, you know, in the theories of monopsony, you always keep the wage rate low. Like labor monopsony in this groundbreaking article by Griffin et al., is discussed as an actual land monopoly, how it is reflected in the labor markets, is a form of institutional labor control mechanism when you are the only employer in the village, you basically set the rules, you set the wages quite low. So this is an interesting pattern to catch. And in the other regions, there is labor surplus. But I did take this analysis and maybe, you know, I'm hoping that this is some sort of a contribution to the literature, fulfill the empirical gap about this theory, and wanted to come up with a macro relationship that I looked at how land ownership inequality is affecting the functioning of rural markets. You know, if you were to define a good functioning of rural markets by this wage equality and no wage dispersion, then I ran this very basic regression. This is a village fixed effects regression. And wanted to look at, okay, does the functioning of these labor markets affected by land ownership inequality? In other words, if there is high land ownership inequality, does it have a positive association with the wage diversion? And my results, I have conducted in three levels, city, town, you know, and city. I have 73 cities, provinces, like I said, 500 villages, and 300-something towns. They're all significant. So 1% increase in land ownership inequality is associated with, just for the province level, let me say, and then move on, 2.67% of wage diversion. So it is very positively and significantly related with the failure in labor markets. So my first round of conclusions is that, well, when it comes to agrarian organization, land inequality, that basic structure that markets sit on, makes a difference. Because through different channels of credit and labor markets. So those who do not have land, first of all, don't have credit access. Neither do have land access, because land holding markets are associated. They work in labor markets, but labor markets are prone to power structures, which is one of the, you know, one of the basic heterodox messages, at least to the neoclassicals. So for rural markets to function better, or for before making the market-friendly policies at the center of development programs, one needs to think about the initial inequalities, because they do matter. And total agrarian output would have been much higher if land were to be distributed towards the small farms. So how about gender, land ownership, land distribution? As I mentioned, 450 million people have no land, neither do have land access, like no sharecropping, no fixed rent tenancy, no nothing. They just work as laborers. And poorest of the poor are women with no land access. And we have been talking about this quite a bit, and I know this is not a silver bullet, and I know, you know, I can't empirically support this work, but I'm just going to infer a couple of insights. There are three main structures where women are either limited or would enhance their access to land. And this is the framework borrowed from Bina Agarwal, who is the flag carrier and the pioneer in this field, family, state, and market. And I'm not going to really spend a long time because, you know, this has been done much in a much more profound way by others in the room and also by her. I will just post her article. But before going into maybe gender land rights, let me define, and by Bina Agarwal's words, what gender land rights mean. They are effective and independent rights in land, can be defined as including legal rights as well as the social recognition of these rights and effective control over land that are formally untied to male ownership and enforceable by an external legitimized authority such as the community or the state. So how does gender land rights can help the you know, can have women's position in society. There are a couple of arguments which I just want to focus on the empowerment one, because welfare, efficiency have been a bit discussed before, and I would be more than happy to answer questions. But maybe one of the most important thing about the effective rights in land is that it plays the role of a facilitator for gender, you know, for change and gender equality. And how does it do that? Well, again, going through the same channels within the family, increased bargaining power. Well, increased bargaining power because now you have a fallback position of land. So in the decisions about your children, you have a much stronger bargaining power. Within the state, well, there are a lot of literature that looks, that ties the rural political participation to ownership of land. So it also increased women's participation in decision-making within the state. And within markets, again, increased bargaining power for better wages and better work condition and easier access to cheaper, you know, formal credit because now you have the collateral. And within society, women with property are treated with much more respect, in a sense. So it is a way, or it is a really major tool, in my opinion, to be able to start this change in a really dynamic way. I mean, now I have the microphone. I actually would like to say something maybe about education. Bolo was really emphasizing education. I don't know how it is in other countries, but in my country, because education is, you know, yes, there are attempts to provide it universally, but education is very much tied to also who has the money to send their kids to school or who has the land. And land is a wealth-generating asset. Therefore, it is really more important than, I would say, other forms of assets, such as jewelry or money, because during the times of financial crisis or a failed crop, the first to be sold is always jewelry, and that's the woman's asset. But land is the last to be sold. It's also very important in countries like Turkey, where the capital markets are not developed enough. It's used as a hedge against inflation, which used to be a big problem. So I think it's a pretty good solution, but of course it's not a silver bullet, of course, for economic change, for social change. And so one final word I wanted to say, if you educate a boy, you educate a human being, right? If you educate a girl, you educate generations, because women do educate their kids. So if you give rights to land to a man, you feed a family. If you give land to a woman, you start to change the world for the better, I think. And I know, you know, I actually emphasize that this is not the sharing, this is the knowledge about Turkey. I'm sure this is not the maybe pressing case in your country, so I am going to open the floor for discussion on this. But before that, the very last word, come visit Turkey. Agriculture is in ruins, literally. We need the tourism business. It's a really nice place with nice beaches.
Just to continue with the pictures that you showed along the beaches, they're about the land ownership of women. You know, in the Mediterranean, the lands that were thought to be poor were given to girls in the old times, and men were owning the lands inside where there were cultivation and all those things. And when Turkey started to introduce tourism, then now we have, in fact, at that region, at that particular region in the Mediterranean, very wealthy women who happen to be all of a sudden owning lands which are open to tourism. That's I wanted to add about the land ownership, but accidentally. As for the impact of the neoliberal policies, it had really dramatic effects on Turkey, which I want to elaborate later on Friday too, in terms of dislocation of labor from agricultural areas And now the labor employment, labor generation in the urban areas cannot offset the masses that are dislocated from the agricultural sector. And now, I think during this crisis, not in the previous crisis, but particularly in this crisis, because of the backward linkages of people in the urban areas are cut off, we will be having harder times in terms of, you know, people cannot return back and feed themselves from the agricultural anymore, because there's really a collapse in that sector.
I have two questions. The first one has to do with the result that you showed to us, which suggests that smaller farms are more productive than larger farms. I think the implications, the policy implications of this result are really major. And my question is, what is the story behind that result? Because, you know, when it comes to larger farms being more productive, usually we think of the average cost going down, given the fixed cost. So what is happening? What is the rationale behind, you think, arriving or having that result? I also have some ideas on that, but I would like to hear what you have to say. And the second question has to do with the wage band. I think I would like to hear more about specifically how you constructed it. And then the result itself, which suggests that regions with higher land inequality they have the wider band, right? Again, what is the story behind that result? What is the mechanism via which that happens? Thank you.
Okay, I believe I will definitely go to Turkey for several days. Because actually, I really appreciate the study, because it shows things that are real in our different countries, and definitely, small farmers are more productive. Yes, in school we also. I mean, we have all those theory about cost and so on and so on. But when you start looking at the picture, the real data from the different countries, and I've looked at the data from Ghana and from Côte d'Ivoire, from the, the National Agricultural Census, and it's very striking. Small farmers are more productive. Now, how do we explain that more rationally? I have the same question that she asked. The issue of land and women. Now, gender is really culturally and socially rooted. So it's very different from one country to another. And when this morning, many people talk about, land being transmitted by, from women to women in families. But this is not the case in most African countries. In most African countries, land will be owned by men, and then they will give a parcel to women to cultivate. Now, the story is there is what? Is when you look at the plot that the women are cultivating, they have more product to feed families than what actually men are producing. Not because they don't produce a lot, but they sell it because they want to have revenue for the family and so on. But what the women are cultivating is what is actually used, at least in the rural area, to feed families. And so the issue of women having not access but having ownership on land is very important, because if you just have access, it's very insecure. At any time, the guy can just say, okay, give me my land, I will just do this. And I mean, there's no way you will feed anymore your kid, and so on and so on. And so the issue of land ownership is a very, very, very important issue, at least in my opinion. Now, there is a little bit problem there on your, I mean, first or second slide about child labor, I believe. I don't know if it, I saw Ivory Coast, cocoa, child labor, and I'm not sure about the... Well, the whole issue on child labor is very tricky. Because most of the time when you, and this is a very high-level discussion that we have with the guy from ILO, the way they define child labor is not well suited to the way our families raid the kid in our countries. And sometimes you may say there is child labor, but truly, this is not, in our society, considered to be child labor. So the figure, I see cocoa in the Côte d'Ivoire. I don't know what it, if it is related to 7 to 10 of child labor. It's related to child labor, actually. And we do have a survey on child labor in cocoa and coffee, and the story is a little bit different. I know there has been a lot of discussion on child labor and cocoa in Côte d'Ivoire in the recent years. Child labor is not that high. Okay, good. Okay, I stop there.
Thank you for your presentation. Just some comments. We are talking about resources, and one of the rules is the access to the credit. But by the way, we have to be sure that the credit is coming with a secure, because the agriculture sector is the more vulnerable area. And now with the change of the weather and the seeds that we are importing and everything that make us much vulnerable. Another thing is about to push the domestic production, no? To care about the domestic production. But also the domestic production has to compete with the markets, with the supermarket, for example, in our areas. And one of the things that is really expensive for us is the transportation. Yeah. And when we come with our products to the city, we have to compete with the supermarket that are now working in the contract agriculture system. And they don't take any risk, but they have that really low prices. And that is another problem that we have to face in this sense. And another thing is, again, about resource. We are talking about resource every time, but we have to take care about the time of the woman. Because even if they have many resources and they don't have time to produce, they have a lot of work to do. For example, the social work in our areas is really, really hard. They spend about 1.5 days doing the thing that the government should do. And they spend a lot of time in transportation, they spend a lot of time because they don't have water, and many things like are part of the resource that they need. That's all.
I have a few comments. I think your size-productivity relationship, inverse relationship, is very well established thing, but I would like to caution that there is a concept called economic holding or the minimum holding which is viable. So you can't go below that. So that is one thing which we have to keep in mind. Otherwise, it becomes non-viable and non-productivity. My second question is about the relationship between land distribution and economic growth. That means because of productivity, you are suggesting that, and land redistribution we help, etc. But there is one thing that land distribution has got several immediate advantages, like having better status, access to credit, and so on and so forth. But in order to achieve sustainable growth from that land, you require engendering of agricultural policy. Because without that, you cannot have sustainable agricultural growth, even though you are redistributing land. Thirdly, about your labor, when you're talking about labor, are you including family labor also in your this thing? Because on small holdings, family labor would be predominant and hired labor would be much less. And lastly, you know, I mean, I'm not against it, but you know, how much can you romanticize women's role in family? Because women also want profits. Women also want higher incomes. So it is not necessary that when women are owners of land, the world will change or something like that. I think let us not romanticize so much. They are also human beings, rational human beings, functioning in the market system, and they will also have similar kind of behavior, though their inclination towards family would be high, definitely.
Land size productivity debate is going on in India for last 50 years, maybe. Because Amartya Sen is the first person who have shown, he has shown similar kind of results. And, you know, a lot of Marxist agricultural economists like Krishna Bharadwaj, Utsav Patnaik, they have said that, well, that way if you calculate productivity, then it would show probably this kind of trend. But point is what Madam was referring to, lot of family labor, unpaid labor is involved. In your data also was showing that, region-wise per acre number of laborers, I think something was there. So it would be important to calculate what is the productivity per agricultural laborer or per person, instead of productivity per acre.
Is the mic on? So I'm going to start first question first. I think Yelda, you just had some comments about the tourism, but not so. I totally agree with that. And so Tamar, why smaller farms are larger? There are actually three main reasons in the literature covered. First of all, in traditional agriculture, you know, agriculture is a very labor-intensive production, and putting extra labor always pays off. It's always better weeding, better taking care of the land. Therefore, you know, the second slide is basically the culprit of the inverse size relationship, which is they put so much labor in land. That's one of the explanations. And there's a reason why the smaller farms use so much labor, because the opportunity cost of labor is so low, you know, the law of one price doesn't hold for rural markets. Labor is much cheaper for smaller farms, they use it more. Labor is, agriculture is labor intensive, you get yields. And capitalism can land is much cheaper for large farms, they use more, labor is expensive because of supervision costs. That's one explanation. The next explanation is the intensive cultivation, like crop intensity and multi-harvesting that I was referring in the morning. I mean, if you have a large land, you may not really kill yourself to fill every bit of land because your survival doesn't depend on it. Therefore, your land utilization is extremely high in small farms as opposed to the large ones, because you don't cultivate like zillion different things. Of course, that then increases the total amount of output per acre in smaller farms. And the third explanation is that large farms do have more idle land. You know, the calculations are based on the total land holdings, not cultivated land. But I did actually ran my regressions also on cultivated land, and I got the exact same results. And you may then say, well, then it's not technical efficiency. Then I may say, let's ask the right, technical efficiency may not be the right question to ask in a country where there's land scarcity and labor, labor extra labor supply because you really want to increase the productivity of your, you know, scarce factor. And maybe this relates to the maybe the last point or one of the points about the how about looking at the labor productivity. I thought that I kind of maybe briefly mentioned, but maybe not so clear. You know, the choice of technology is very important, and it's a political question. Actually, Amartya Sen mentions that in his book. Like, if you have so much surplus labor, why choose a, you know, capital-intensive production as opposed to a labor-intensive production? You know, if we put the human being in the center and want to employ them more, really, why look into, at least in the short or the medium run, increase the labor productivity? Because you can increase the labor productivity in large farms by hiring very few people. So therefore, it's really, I mean, in the context of developing countries, at least it doesn't really make sense to take into account only the cultivated land. So, you know, it's a question of allocative efficiency versus technical efficiency. That, you know, allocative efficiency should be the target and therefore the maybe the point of analysis in that. About the wage band, how you calculate the marginal productivity of laborers, you fit a production function to your data. Like, you know, I fitted a Cobb Douglas production function in log specification, and I took the elasticity of labor input and multiplied that with the total output and divided by the number of working age adults in the family, which gave me the marginal productivity of labor. I thought that was a technical part. So the regions with higher land inequality, what is my explanation for why, you know, the wage diversion is larger? This is also work which is theoretically covered by Griffin et al. In the land monopoly market. That it's basically labor monopsony. When you have a higher concentration, you know, your opportunities for employment are quite limited. There is an extreme. What it suggests is that when there is higher land, you know, inequality, you have smaller plots of land for the rest of the population with lots of labor, free labor, and so basically the landlord or the chieftain says, "I just pay this much. It's your choice to work or not." And, you know, if you don't have any land, I mean without the markets, of course, you know, most of the people in the world that's going to be dead would be the poor because they sell their labor in the labor markets. And if your only choice is just to work for very little, that's what you do. So this is the theories of monopsony, basically. The labor monopsony theories that if you're a monopsony in a labor market, you keep the wages low. That's the mechanism through which it suppresses wages. I mean, I haven't really discussed a lot of things that has been covered in the literature or neither in my own research, but, you know, most of the time the large landlord is not only the monopsony but also the buyer of the output, seller of the inputs, fertilizers, and also the credit provider in the village, particularly if the village is isolated in a rural space, which, you know, most of the agricultural production is conducted. Land and woman, Noon, your point about culture, you know, countries are different culturally. I totally agree with that, but at the same time, to have policy space, I don't think culture is God-given. It's a platform for contestation. And we contest when we have stronger bargaining power. So the point, without evidence, just based on, you know, my readings and the discussion, is that you can use land ownership compared to any other asset, more so as a tool for contestation to really make your case. I mean, culture is a living organism, like people. It changes, and it changes because people contest. And the way to contest, you know, you contest when you know that if it fails, you're not going to go hungry. So if you have land, then you may. So, you know, I mean, in India, as a result of Bina Agarwal's work in 1994, now there are so many platforms that this issue has been discussed, and there has been changes. I think Indra would, you know much more than I do. So I don't know if I have responded to all your points, but so Lorraine, I'm not clear if I was able to catch your question about access to credit, but I totally agree with you on the transportation. and the domestic production, you know, competes with the supermarket. Maybe you can rephrase your question again for me. I don't know particularly the one about the credit, but domestic production competes with the supermarket. Yes, it is true, but because the market structure is, you know, the market structure is in a way that, you know, supermarkets act as some sort of a power structure in the agricultural markets. I mean, they don't really want to deal with maybe too many small farmers. And I'm going to again refer back to my small farm size argument, and also touching on Indira's point. Yes, there has to be an optimal size of farms. And when you produce enough for yourself plus some marketed marketable surplus, I mean, yeah, I know these are very maybe optimistic or brave or overly generalized, you know, insights, I may say. But imagine, you know, my village size, for example, the village my father belongs, the household size was 300 something in 1980s, now it's 22. So the production is a bit concentrated, most people left. But I'm thinking if people were able to make their livelihoods with some marketable surplus, then people's food supply won't be relying so much on supermarkets or their mechanisms to transfer that surplus to the cities or to the nearby markets wouldn't be so much in the hands of the supermarket. Is this a long-term solution? I'm probably one of the last people who would like to romanticize agriculture, agriculture, because I know it's very, very hard work. But at the same time, I think I have this observation, at least based on my work in Turkey, that first of all, in the short run, you know, you change your country, you change the world, but while doing that change, whose lives are you going to cost? I mean, change is possible, like it is done in, Korea, Singapore, Japan, as a result of, you know, redistributing land to the small farmers and then getting that surplus, really not without killing so many people and, you know, costing lives. So, given, you know, I'm emphasizing that over and over and over again, given that you don't have any non-farm employment opportunities, this may be the way to go till you form that linkages with industry and create employment opportunities that you don't let your people die, basically. Don't try to eliminate small farming because they're not competitive enough, because the other side of, you know, you're not competitive enough is, you know, there's no land for you, you're consolidating, it's more competitive, but also there's no job for you. I don't know, at least that's my take on it. Indira, optimal size, I totally agree. I mean, it's, you know, I'm not suggesting that because there's also the the land overutilization issues when it comes to small farming. They irrigate more, they fertilize more, you know, they work a lot, and there is a lot of underemployment of the labor because they work so much on it. And if you were to kind of withdraw a couple of the family members, the output may stay the same. It suggests actually there is hidden unemployment in agriculture, which is also the case, particularly in small farms. So there's definitely an optimal size. But my results, like it is seen in also observed in many of the developing countries, suggest that, you know, larger farms don't really, you know, there should be an increase in total output in agriculture if land were to be distributed. Okay, sustainable growth, land distribution, economic growth, sustainable growth. I mean, I am trained by an agricultural economist who would say that you can't know the political economy of development without knowing the political economy of agriculture. So all countries grow or transform, you know, this big agrarian question, how to transform your agricultural sector to industry eventually. This is where all we want to get. Increase our options. Don't spend your time on the farm all the time. For sustainable growth, this is the path to take for sure. And there are different paths that different countries have taken. But for Turkey, I think the path to be taken in the short run is going to be first really increase the output. Maybe this is mostly for right now trying to increase the agricultural surplus and then being able to transfer this to the industrial sector. Living off of small farms may be sustainable growth for Turkey, but may not be modern economic development as it is contextualized in our world. You know, maybe it's not modern economic development that with a very small share of labor working in agriculture, producing a lot, it's mechanized. I think the, you know, historical development of the country, other conditions, the employment opportunities will determine all that. But, you know, I know I'm rambling because I think I don't have a really very clear answer to that. That this is the most human-centered path I see right now. And how much can I romanticize women's land rights because they are owners of land? Yeah, I totally agree with that, but I'm just going to say, why not a change? It has been in the hands of men for so long, so why not transfer it to women and see what's going to change? And in my I guess I answered that labor, why not labor productivity? And in my labor calculations, do I take the family, the unpaid family labor into account? Yes, I did, because I divided the total output by the working, you know, the number of, actually the reported number of, this is how many days we worked. So maybe yes and no, because it's not really clear if they, you know, there's first of all no gender discrimination in the, you know, gender variable in the data. Women work this much, men work this much. So I just took the total man days put into the production. So it may include or may not include. But I don't know how many of you have been to a farm or to a village in a rural area, but basically everyone works. And the question in the survey is asked, how many days did you spend on, let's say, you know, the field preparation, the harvest, the this, the that, whatnot. So I'm assuming it's combining the unpaid labor.